Arizona's public campaign funding system has been taking some hits, from the elimination of matching funds to taking away some of its enforcement power. But hey, it could have been worse.
One of the publications in the state actually put the Clean Elections logo on their cover with a sinking in the quicksand at the beginning of the session. And very quickly it became clear that none of those worst-case scenarios were going to come to fruition.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, Clean Elections and the rest of the legislative session, also how the state's dry winter could affect the valley's water.
Mesa is losing one of its university campuses. What do schools look for when they branch out?
And cities on the urban B list, Phoenix versus places like Austin and Portland.
People go there for that cool, hip vibe. And I think we're still trying to change that whole narrative of downtown Phoenix, that it's unsafe, there's nothing cool.
Plus, a hot corner and gamers are hot on the trail of an urban legend.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Couple quick traffic notes to pass along. State Route 87, the Beeline Highway, is closed at Gilbert Road due to an accident. You'll have to find a different route in that area. Also, the 101 southbound in the East Valley, an accident at Broadway. And I-10 eastbound, the shoulder blocked by an accident at 16th Street. Sunny skies with a high of 92 for the rest of this afternoon. Cloudy tomorrow, though, and much cooler with a high of 73 degrees. It's 90 right now.
Part of the Loop 101 in Scottsdale was closed earlier today as authorities dealt with a suicidal person on the Thomas Road overpass. The northbound closure started a mile south at McDowell. Southbound traffic had to exit the freeway at Thomas.
After a long dispute, the Hualapai tribe and the family of a Las Vegas businessman have finally reached a financial settlement over the Grand Canyon Skywalk. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
The Hualapai tribe owns the horseshoe-shaped walkway over the west rim of the Grand Canyon. The developer, David Jin, died last year, but his family pursued the $277 million they claimed were owed him. For 3 years, the Hualapai and the developer went back and forth. The tribe tried to use an eminent domain ordinance to write Jin out of his management role. They argued Jin breached his contract when he didn't complete a visitor center. Jin had invested $30 million into the glass bridge. Jin accused the tribe of embezzlement and fraud, claiming they invoked tribal sovereignty as an excuse for not producing financial records. The terms of the settlement had been sealed by court order, and both sides could not comment for this story. The chairwoman released a statement thanking Jin for his contribution to the attraction. Jin's widow said he would be so proud that people from all over the world will continue to appreciate the architectural marvel he created. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Governor Jan Brewer has signed a bill to create a new alert system for seniors who disappear unexpectedly. Today's signing of Senate Bill 1097 creates a silver alert system modeled after amber alerts, which notify the public when a child has gone missing.
It's over for now. The state legislature adjourned its regular session early yesterday morning with its usual flurry of last-minute activity, but their break will likely be a short one. Governor Brewer is expected to call a special session next month to deal with child welfare. Stepping back out on the ledge with us is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Hi, Howie.
Well, I'll be glad to jump as soon as somebody tells me.
So how chaotic was the end of this year's session compared to past ones?
Well, in some ways, it wasn't terribly bad. I mean, the budget had been already taken out of the way. Most of the controversial issues had, except for two. One of them had to do with this whole question of rideshare, Uber, Lyft.
And Lyft, right.
And these were very contentious because there were a lot of folks say, why should we stand in the way of new technology? And the opponents saying, and why should they get a break from the rules that govern taxis? And that took a lot of attention and a lot of heat. And as we know now, the governor vetoed the measure. The other controversial issue, which is still on our desk, is one about the ongoing fight between optometrists and ophthalmologists about what medications optometrists, who are not medical doctors, get to administer. And that took probably into the wee hours of the morning. And that was, in fact, the last bill the House voted on.
So what was the mood like toward the end of the session? Last year, it seemed like there were a lot of hurt feelings, a lot of people sort of just ready to be done with each other. Was it like that this year?
No, because you didn't quite have the same sort of schism in the Republican Party. Last year, as you point out, we had a situation where a handful of Republicans had united with the Democrats and the governor to not only push through Medicaid, but push through a budget that was much more to the Democrats' liking. This year, there were some issues that you had some of the, I'll use the term loosely, moderate Republicans siding with the Democrats on. Some of the issues over things like expanded voucher programs and help for charter schools. But it wasn't quite as divisive.
Was there an issue this year that was like Medicaid's debate last year that just so clearly defined the session?
Well, mainly the budget, you know, the whole question of how much can we afford to spend. You know, the fact remains that we adopted a quote-unquote balanced budget. And I'm using the term, again, very loosely, because, yes, the amount of money that we've got is equal to the amount of money that we're planning to spend. But that has to do with the fact that there was a $600 million cash carry forward. That was money left over from the 1 cent sales tax that expired May 30th. That money is going to disappear. It's not going to be there. And by FY17, depending on whose numbers you believe, we will either be $200 million in the black, according to the governor, or perhaps $500 million in the hole, according to legislative budget analysts. And there are a lot of folks who are worried about, you know, how do we get there? Should we have done something else? Now, from the Republicans' perspective, the something else is cutting the size of government. From the Democrats' perspective is, why do we continue to give away tax breaks? Because they have not produced the number of jobs that have been promised.
So you referenced one of the bills that the governor still has to act on, the optometrist, ophthalmologist bill. Are there others that are of note that are still sitting on her desk?
Well, what's fascinating at this time of year is we get bills that come back, including vetoes, on bills that none of us had thought were controversial. I mean, for example, one of the bills she vetoed earlier this week dealt with creating a state agency to look at the efficiency of state agencies, if you will. And the governor said, why are we doing that? We don't need legislation. There are a couple of more gun bills out there. I think they're mainly minor issues. But it's hard to know what's controversial, at least in the mind of the governor. There's a lot of stuff out there, and I have a feeling that we're going to be seeing a lot of headlines between now and May 6th, which is her deadline for signing or vetoing anything that's left.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
Now that the regular legislative session is over, lawmakers who are running for re-election or some other office can focus on their campaigns, including raising money. To that end, one bill passed strips the Citizens Clean Elections Commission of the power to enforce the spending of candidates who don't accept public funding for their campaigns. Tom Collins is executive director of the commission and says he's disappointed that Governor Brewer signed SB 1344.
We have two concerns. The first is that the bill does not actually appear to affect the Clean Elections Commission, even though folks in the legislature are saying it did. It said that the Clean Elections Commission shouldn't enforce Article 1 of the Campaign Finance Code, but the Clean Elections Act is Article 2. And Article 2 applies to all candidates for state office, whether or not they're taking public financing or not. So that confusion is one thing that concerns us. The second thing that concerns us is because the Clean Elections Act applies to all candidates, whether they take public financing or not, regardless of public financing, in fact, and because the Arizona Supreme Court has already held that this likely violates the Voter Protection Act, which prevents voter-enacted measures from being amended without a three-quarter vote or in furtherance of them. So we think that this is engendering the possibility of litigation, regardless of what the commission ultimately chooses to consider. The commission will have to evaluate all these things and balance them and figure out what its role is and how it should proceed. This bill does nothing to give us stability in the system. It creates more confusion than is necessary and may, in fact, be completely ineffective in terms of the commission's role. And the commission, of course, believes and in fact, does, as a matter of law, have authority over all candidates.
What does the enforcement provision as it stands now entail? What does that mean when the commission gets involved, whether it's someone who is taking clean elections money or not?
Enforcement will be done by a multi-party commission that is not responsible to an elected official and will be done in open session, and everyone will get a chance to be heard. And so that's we're the only place in the process, the only executive branch place where folks have an opportunity to be heard, where decisions are made in the open, and where decisions are not controlled by an elected official. The voters wanted a system that was open to the public. They wanted a system where elected officials and the appearance of conflicts and conflicts that are raised when elected officials are doing this kind of enforcement in this kind of area. And they wanted to break through all that with a multipartisan commission that met in open session and had to have open votes on what to do with these cases.
How big, Tom, was the target on the back of clean elections during this most recent session that ended this week?
I think it's ironic because one of the leading publications in the state actually put the Clean Elections logo on their cover with a sinking in the quicksand at the beginning of the session. And very quickly it became clear that none of those worst-case scenarios were going to come to fruition. In fact, the legislation was passed and signed by the governor that made permanent our eQual program that allows you to sign petition signatures and give $5 qualifying contributions online. That passed. That made that pilot program permanent. I would just say that the naysayers and folks who thought the Clean Elections was going to have a target on its back in January were proved wrong. We think we had overall a very successful session.
Tom Collins is executive director of the Citizens Clean Elections Commission.
Still to come, polygamous families continue to be in the news and on reality TV, but for one family living out of the spotlight, their plural marriage has become singular.
We still try to do family activities, holidays, everything together still as a family. The only dynamic that's changed is that Temple and I are no longer in a polygamous relationship.
That's coming up. It's the show.
You don't have to be a meteorologist to know we had a dry winter. Below average precip, as the cool kids call it, means reduced snowpack, which means less water in rivers, streams, and reservoirs.
In fact, the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service in Phoenix, which tracks these things, reports the Salt and Verde rivers are running at about 22% of their normal flow. That's about a quarter of where the two main central Arizona rivers should be at this time of year. Dino DeSimone is the agency's water supply specialist.
Well, this definitely was a way below normal winter and snowpack for us. The last time we had a snowpack this low was about 2006, and before that about 2002. So every few years we have a low snowpack, and this was definitely one of them.
In reading through your agency's report from earlier this month, it looks like the sort of takeaway was well below.
Yes.
Everything was well below average.
In all of our basins around the state, we didn't have any exceptions this time. Sometimes we do, but the Salt and Verde systems, the Gila system, all of it was way below normal snowpack, and also total rainfall was way below normal.
What does that mean for cities that need that water?
Well, fortunately, the reservoirs along the Salt and Verde systems are still at a little over half of their capacity right now. That's because we did have a good monsoon last year, and we did have a pretty good winter a few years ago, and they're able to store that water for a long period of time. So we're still at about 50%+ of capacity in those reservoirs. However, this year, we're not going to be adding to that very much at all.
How long does it take to really deplete some of that? I mean, you mentioned that we're about half full or so in a lot of those reservoirs, but in a year like this where we're not adding anything to it, how much will it get depleted, but let's say, by the end of the summer?
Well, working with my partners there at SRP, it will go down maybe to 40% if we just have a normal spring and summer season here. They get concerned when we have a series of these low snowpack years in a row. And we're hopeful that this next winter will be above normal. We're looking at the El Nino coming back again. So hopefully we won't get these reservoirs depleted too much.
Is that what happened the last couple times? Did we get wet winters after that?
Yes. I mean, this is typical of Arizona. We live in this desert environment, and we talk about normals, but I laugh about it because there's really no normal in Arizona. We definitely expect and hope that when we have a dry snowpack year like this, that we'll have a good monsoon or at least a good snowpack next winter.
You described the point at which some of your colleagues get nervous about where lakes and reservoirs are. When do you get nervous?
Well, the time frame we use generally in Arizona is a three-year dry period. So when we have 3 years in a row of below normal rainfall and snow, we say we're getting into a severe drought situation. We were approaching that until last monsoon. This last summer saved us because that really brought us a lot of precip and helped fill the reservoirs. So we're kind of starting the clock over again here with this dry winter. And again, if we get 3 years in a row, we get to the point where we're calling that a severe drought situation.
Does one good monsoon season make up for essentially 2.5 bad years?
Just about. This last monsoon was way above normal and did make up for a lot of the dry period. However, now, with this dry winter, I work with the governor's drought committee, and at this point, our latest report for April shows that every area of the state is in some state of a drought now because of this dry winter again.
How optimistic are you that this monsoon season will be wet and that next winter we'll get some snow up north in the mountains and some rain down here?
Well, the latest projections by our climatologist and our partners at SRP is that we should have about an average monsoon this summer, but above average next winter. We're, again, getting signals that the El Nino is returning and that we should have a good snowpack this next winter. So I'm pretty optimistic at this point.
Dino DeSimone is the water supply specialist at the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service in Phoenix.
Water is always a concern in the valley, seems even more so as we start to enter the hot months. The Phoenix City Council acted this week to focus on ensuring the community has enough water for the future. Among the votes was the unanimous approval of a partnership with Tucson water providers, allowing for the storage and recovery of Central Arizona Project water between the two cities. Ken Krosky is Public Information Officer for the City of Phoenix's Water Services Department. Where are we getting our water from, and how is it possible that in this desert city we're actually doing pretty well?
Well, it is amazing, Steve, and I think the world as a whole doesn't understand water in the Sonoran Desert. Most of our water in Phoenix comes from snowpack over various watersheds. So our rain helps, but it's not the major factor. About 90% of our water is what they call surface water. We actually get more water from the Salton Verde rivers than we do from the Colorado. Many people think we only get Colorado River water. We also use a little bit of groundwater, but we have a balanced, methodical approach to how we plan for water for many decades. And that isn't just our water sources. It's the fact that we reuse nearly all of our wastewater for energy production, Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station, crops, wetlands, and a little bit for recharge. Right now, we're using about the same amount of water as we did 20 years ago in Phoenix. So that speaks to a conservation culture and a public awareness culture that our customers have really bought into.
Ken, the Phoenix City Council has approved a partnership with Tucson water providers. What would that do?
Phoenix does not use all of the water that it's entitled to right now. So the concept then is that Tucson would store that water underground and have it available to them. And later, if the drought gets extreme, if there is a mega drought that really affects our water supplies, Phoenix could pull Tucson's water off of the river. Now, what that does is enables both entities to spend less money later on to access that water. And it really looks at the long term. And it's part of that multi-layered approach, that comprehensive approach that can benefit a lot of different people.
Ken, another council decision referred to climate change and its possible effect on the water supply in the Phoenix area. Climate change is a pretty controversial term to some people. Is it less so in this area based on the possible impact?
I think we understand the effects of our water supplies because we live in the desert, not in spite of it. And that's very difficult for other people in other regions to understand. So it's not that we feel more comfortable with anything. If anything, we want those insurance policies and we want to understand every factor that plays into our water supplies for the future. And we're kind of in the infancy with climate change now, and everyone around the world is going to have to deal with that affects their particular climate, including Phoenix and Valley and Arizona in general.
You've mentioned that this community has done a pretty good job as it relates to conservation, but there are many who say that the cost of water is just too low, and that's one way of dealing even with the current budget deficit in the city is to raise water rates. Is that something that the department is keeping its eyes on?
We need to continue that conservation, that wise water use ethic, especially when it comes to outdoors, Steve, because our desert-adapted plants are what use very little water. And yes, our rates are still among the lowest in the country, which is great. But a lot of the things that are going into our water supply and our infrastructure, as in every part of the world, will increase in the future. So the rates will be affected at some point.
Ken Krosky of the City of Phoenix Water Services Department. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In KJZZ News, Governor Jan Brewer has signed a bill into law allowing the Arizona Attorney General to fight subpoenas issued in a civil case seeking to get the remainder of the state's 2010 immigration law, SB 1070, thrown out. Valley weather for tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with a slight chance for rain after midnight. Breezy conditions as well. Look for lows in the mid-60s. And then for tomorrow, a 40% chance for rain and windy with a high only reaching 73 degrees. Quick check of Valley traffic at this hour. There's one accident to report on State Route 87 southbound at Gilbert Road.
KJZZ is supported by SRP Community Solar, offering customers a way to get solar energy without rooftop panels. More information at srpcommunitysolar.com.
There are more than a couple of reality shows about polygamy on TV, and the issue is occasionally in the news here because of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints communities in and around Colorado City. But what happens when a polygamous family that is not a part of the FLDS Church becomes monogamous? Moroni Jessup was in a polygamous marriage with his wife Martha and his now former wife Temple Skousen. Since Moroni and Temple have separated, Temple has remarried.
We decided at the onset that we wanted to do it in such a way that we maintained a family relationship. So, in other words, my children with Temple come over and stay with me quite frequently, and a lot of times vice versa. Even Martha's children go over and spend time with Temple. And in addition to that, we still try to do, you know, family activities, holidays. You know, everything together still is a family. The only dynamic that's changed is that Temple and I are no longer in a polygamous relationship.
Martha, how has it changed for you?
I'm still great friends with Temple, and I love her very much and still consider her part of the family. And I consider her one of my best friends still. The change is different for me because she's not always there all the time, like at my house. But I do talk to her still frequently, and we communicate quite often.
Temple, I want to ask you the same question, and I'm interested especially in your perspective because on the outside it would seem like maybe the changes that you're undergoing or have undergone would be slightly different than those of Martha and Moroni.
Yeah, sure. I think there's definitely a difference there because, you know, they started out as a unit prior to me and they are continuing on as a unit. As far as like it affecting my faith, I am LDS. I'm just not fundamentalist. So, you know, I'm still a spiritual person. I rely on my Heavenly Father for guidance. And Martha and I are still, like she said, really great friends. And then the same with Moroni and I.
So Moroni and Martha, are you interested in trying to add another wife to the family? Are you looking to get back into a plural relationship?
Well, maybe Martha should tell you that one of the first things she told me when we made this change in our lifestyle in regard to plural marriage. Maybe she should answer that.
Well, I told him, well, the next time you do this, you need to marry two instead of one. That way, you know, you'll still be in it if someone decides to go. I told them that. So I definitely believe this way. And, you know, this is part of my faith. I'm definitely interested in living again.
Moroni, how has this change going from a plural marriage to a monogamous marriage, at least for the time being, perhaps? How has this sort of changed how you see yourself and how others in your community see you?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, one of the things I noticed that in the polygamous communities, I've noticed a difference because there seems to be some sort of cred that goes along with having more than one wife. And I notice that in some ways, my opinions get a little bit marginalized in our circles because I'm a monogamous now.
Temple, I want to ask, do you see yourself differently in what some might call a traditional marriage as opposed to a plural marriage?
Well, I can tell you I keep a lot more food in the house longer. I'm just joking. My perception of myself has not really changed. I've always been comfortable with who I am and with the decisions that I have made in my life. My perception of myself, I think, is still pretty good. I'm a very capable person. I became a EMT, volunteer firefighter, and I'm a very capable mother. So that part is all good.
Do you think people in your community see you differently now?
You know, in the fundamental community, yeah, nobody talks to me anymore. It's like they would have rather seen me leave and take kids and whatever than stick around and continue to have a good relationship and stuff like that. So that part, it is what it is, but in all honesty, I don't need anybody else to make me feel good at the end of the day.
Does it make living your life more difficult when there are, for example, stories in the news about goings-on in a place like Colorado City? Does that make your life more difficult when stuff like that is out there?
Well, first of all, one thing that's been frustrating is the way the media has portrayed plural marriages as far as, you know, child brides, as far as arranged marriages, forced marriages, because that really only represents a small fraction of the Mormon polygamous community, and it doesn't reflect our views, and it never has. So when people make assumptions that just because you're polygamous that, you know, you must be that way, you know, it does get a little frustrating. And it is frustrating to see people like Warren Jeffs in the news because in reality he doesn't represent us, and nor do the ideals that he represents. You know, the crimes that he commits, they don't really represent us or fit what we believe and what we practice.
Well, Moroni Jessup, Martha Jessup, and Temple Skallison, thank you all so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Osborne. I'm one of the brewers here at Four Peaks Brewing Company, brewing every day a different batch of beer. I love that it's different every day, to create something new every day. I love that people love what we make. My favorite part is getting in at 4 a.m. and starting the mashing process, because that's when I know my workday is starting. Create something that's going to sit in a fermenter for 2 weeks and go to the bar, and people will drink it and say, make more of that.
Melissa Osborne, brewing beer at Four Peaks Brewery in Tempe. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, or you're just thirsty, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, we hit up another Valley Hot Corner. It's a strip mall, but lots of places to eat.
If you have a cluster, then you're going to bring more people together. And then if one is busy, then they might walk over to another one. And I do think that there is greater strength in numbers.
That story and more ahead. It's the show.
Slight chance for rain tonight around the valley, and then for tomorrow, much cooler than we've seen in recent days. We'll just get up to about 73 degrees with a 40% chance for rain and windy conditions as well. Then sunny and warmer on Sunday, but still below normal. Look for a high temperature of 79. In Valley traffic, one accident to tell you about. It's State Route 87 southbound at Gilbert Road. That intersection is closed.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership. The 2014 Outback offers 32 MPG and large cargo space to fit your lifestyle. Online at shopsubaru.com.
Mesa's push to become a haven for liberal arts college satellite campuses lost one of its inaugural participants when Westminster College announced this week it would leave the Valley after the spring semester. But the Southwest continues to be a leading area for colleges and universities looking to branch out beyond their home borders. But Ron Starner, senior writer for the publication Site Selection, says even Grand Canyon University looked outside the Valley when it moved to expand.
Initially, Grand Canyon University cast a very wide swath in its site search, looking as far away as Albuquerque and Tucson and even some other locations in the Southwest. They engaged Colliers International as their site selection consultant in the project. So Colliers did the on-the-ground analysis of all the prospective sites where they thought GCU would be a good fit, and they submitted a total of 112 prospective sites to GCU for consideration. They specifically detailed what their most important site selection criteria were. They looked at existing college enrollment numbers and detailed demographics in each prospective community. In other words, they wanted to make sure they were not going to an overserved market. They looked at proximity to retail, freeway access, major arterial roadways, and essential infrastructure in the area.
We hear a lot about the importance of improving the education system, primarily K-12, to attract more businesses. But how important is the reverse when it comes to attracting more colleges and universities?
What has changed is that at the community level, cities and counties and economic development agencies have decided that why wait for the colleges to expand when we could go out and recruit new colleges to come to us, which is clearly what Mesa did. They sent out an RFP to about 1,000 colleges around the country and basically said, you know, you come here, we will help develop a centralized campus for you in our city, and you know, we'll make it a lot easier for you to establish your very first satellite campus out in the western United States.
How much planning do colleges do when it comes to making this kind of decision? Because I'm thinking about Westminster leaving Mesa after only a few years.
Colleges and universities all around the country aren't sure of what the ultimate future of college education is going to be. As you know, many of them have ventured off into distance learning projects. And there are many major colleges and universities now that you can attend. You can go all the way through a PhD primarily through distance learning. And really, as you look at what happened in Mesa here, it's really an extension of the distance learning concept because they're just delivering the same curriculum they have over a greater distance and using an actual physical storefront in Mesa to deliver the product.
Ron Starner is a senior writer for the publication Site Selection.
According to some millennials, big cities are so over. Smaller, growing cities are where it's at, and there's some census data to back that up. The top three fastest-growing metro areas include Austin, Raleigh, and San Antonio, sometimes considered B-list cities. But where does that leave Phoenix, a big city but also a growing city? To get some answers, we turn to Armando Carbonell. He chairs the Department of Planning and Urban Form at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
For the metropolitan areas that have more than 1 million people, the 20 fastest growing are predominantly not the biggest. Only three are in the top 10. But what's interesting about that is in the top 10 of the three largest are Dallas, Houston, and Atlanta. So we have Dallas in Texas, Houston in Texas, and then of the smaller ones that are growing fast, Austin in Texas. And actually, number three in terms of fast growth right now is San Antonio. So we have four Texas cities that are right up there in the top 20 fastest growing large metros in the United States. I would suggest that has something to do with Texas, and that something is that the Texas economy has been on a somewhat different path than the rest of the national economy. There's another factor while we're talking about the idea of the B-list cities, and in particular Austin, and that is Austin is a really cool city, and not every B-list city is. Now, Phoenix, in a lot of ways, in my book, is not a B-list city. For one thing, it's a large city. Whether it's cool or not is a matter of opinion, and I'm probably not close enough to being a 30-something to really have an opinion about whether Phoenix is cool. But in any case, I don't think in particular this trend that led to Austin, Texas, being the fastest-growing large metro in the country is necessarily going to apply to Phoenix.
I'm curious how much of people's desires maybe not to live in a place like San Francisco or New York and to live in a place like Austin or Denver or even Dallas, how much of that has to do with the affordability and the availability of housing?
Well, I think it's absolutely key. And one of the things that we saw in New York City, for example, as it became more and more attractive, is that the outer boroughs became much more interesting to people who otherwise would not have looked for housing there. So there has been this spread in the hot cities and the cities that are attractive to young people to the less expensive areas, making them expensive. And thus, and Austin starts to look very attractive in terms of housing cost.
When you look at the kinds of cities that millennials talk about, especially out west, the two that often come to mind are Austin and Portland. And I'm wondering if there's just sort of a reputation that those cities have of being cool and young and hip and the vibe that, people want, that almost no matter what another city does as far as having jobs and housing and other stuff, other amenities, that people are always going to flock to the places that they've heard about and heard are cool.
Well, this is an important factor, and certainly Portland for a time was attracting people who had no idea what kind of jobs they might find when they got there. They were moving to the place because they wanted to be there and hoped to find jobs later. When we look at the millennial group of the population, the younger folks, why might they be coming to Phoenix? Well, there was an investment in a light rail. There was considerable interest in downtown development. This is a more city-oriented group of people. It's going to have something to say about housing demand. The demand is going to be for smaller units. And very often there's a preference for that space closer to the center of a city. Millennials are likely to continue to create a demand for this kind of housing with access to transit. And I would think continue to change the shape of cities like Phoenix, where developers will see the market opportunity to build to that demand.
Armando Carbonell chairs the Department of Planning and Urban Form at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. So if Phoenix wants to continue attracting millennials, where should it look for inspiration? Quinn Wisson with the group This Could Be Phoenix travels to other cities to see what they do and how that could apply here.
There's a lot of differences, especially the places we pick, because we try to pick urban cities where we can go and take something and learn from it. So, for example, in Portland, they have a lot of the same type of kind of disconnected neighborhoods, but at least there it's very walkable and there's light rail and there's a lot of biking culture there. So there's a lot of differences in just the fact that we don't have a lot of those urban amenities yet, but we can at least take it something from those cities and bring it back to Phoenix.
Is that sort of what you see Phoenix maybe needs to do, is take a little bit from here, a little bit from there, a little bit from here, and sort of incorporate it all into what Phoenix is?
I think so. I think the more and more that I do all the city kind of promotion and trying to help Phoenix be awesome, I'm learning that it's a creative process. And with any creative process, you need source material. So you need inspiration. You need to go find what works and what doesn't work. So, you know, going to Portland or going to Detroit and seeing what is successful there helps us to come back and say, what can we do in Phoenix to at least grab some of that essence of what they have in those other cities.
So does that mean that to you there's really not one city that Phoenix should aspire to be?
I don't think so. I think that would just not be giving us enough credit. I think what's amazing about going to different cities is that they are so unique. And if we can't make something uniquely Phoenix, then why try to copy something?
So how do you sort of then take a bit from maybe Portland, a bit from Austin, mm-hmm. a bit from other places, and then still take something that is maybe distinct to Phoenix?
Well, I think you want to take more of the elements that work. So, for example, in Portland, it's very walkable, and they have great bike infrastructure. So that's something we bring back, and we, you know, try to go to budget hearings and talk about that and see how we can make that happen in Phoenix. And, you know, New York, public transportation is amazing. We already have our light rail, which someplace like Austin doesn't have. But then you have to ask the question, well, how can we make this uniquely Phoenix? And that's really a tough question to answer, because it might not be so apparent that there's a specific kind of culture. But I think what makes uniquely Phoenix is really where we live, the natural habitat.
It seems like when people talk about sort of young, cool, hip cities, they think of places like Austin, like mm-hmm. Portland, like Seattle. Do you think that Phoenix is seen that way among anybody? And do you think it could be at some point?
I think it's seen that way by people that live and play in downtown Phoenix. And I think it's interesting because even just on the periphery of downtown, it might not be seen that way. So I think that's the big difference of those other cities, that people go there for that cool, hip vibe. And I think we're still trying to change that whole narrative of downtown Phoenix, that it's unsafe, there's nothing cool, there's nothing going on after the Suns game. There is. So I think it's going to happen. We just need to get that kind of hesitant but interested crowd to come here and try it out.
Is it a good aspiration for Phoenix to try to be competing with cities like Austin and Portland to try to get some people who might say, oh, I'd love to live in Austin, to say, hey, I'd like to live in Phoenix instead?
I think a constructive competition would be best. And I think what a lot of people are worried about still in Phoenix is people are going to leave Phoenix for places like Portland or Seattle. And we have a running joke that every creative person will end up going to Portland. So I think, yes, being competitive in the sense that we can learn from them and try to grab some talent from leaving, not so much trying to get them from Portland here, but trying to retain the talent we already have.
Quinn Wisson is an independent marketing consultant and one of the people behind the community organization This Could Be Phoenix. It's time to head to another of the Valley's hot corners, parts of town with a lot going on. As always, let's meet our tour guide.
I am Gwen Ashley Walters, and I'm a food writer for Phoenix Magazine.
And where are we today?
We are at the shops at Gainey Village.
On Scottsdale Road at Doubletree Ranch Road, north of Indian Bend. Gwen found us some nice seats in the shade, giving us a good vantage point.
It's a very big center, and it's been here for a while.
A lot of restaurants in here.
A lot more now than there used to be.
Why is that?
Gosh, do you think it's the economy? I don't know. You and I have talked about this before, but one restaurant comes up and then another restaurant comes up, and this area is really hot right now. So this is a great hot strip center.
A hot strip mall. This is our first mall. I like it. So what are some of the highlights for you in here?
Well, you know, Pomo just moved up here from the Brigada, and that was really great. And then they opened right next door the Forno Fabri, which is their little Italian market with a mozzarella bar. And, oh, my gosh, it's so cute.
Lots of breads and cheeses in there.
Lots of breads and cheeses and some appetizers. It's just a really fun little place to go and get a glass of wine and a little nibble.
So what else? Driving in here from the south side, we're sitting basically the north end of the strip mall.
We're at the north end, right.
I was shocked by how many places to eat there are in here.
You can't count them on one hand. I guess you can count them on two, but definitely not one hand. So Village Tavern is actually a chain, but they're an anchor. They've been here forever. They're kind of like a Houston's on the south end of it. Paradise Bakery's here. They're also a chain. But then there's a lot of independents here. The new ones are Cuttlefish and Notorious Burger, and those are both by Joey Majoria, whose father is Tommaso. And then the guy that used to have the Bravo Bistro restaurant down in Old Scottsdale, he has opened Naya Mediterranean, which has a very Lebanese slant to it now.
We joked about being in a strip mall, but right. I mean, Phoenix is basically made up of a lot of strip malls throughout the city. So
right.
Is it difficult for a restaurateur to sort of overcome the perception of strip malls as not high-end, not places that you want to be?
I think it depends on the location of the strip mall, because where we sit right now is in a very desirable area. It's very upscale. This doesn't feel like a strip mall to me, though. Does it to you? Because it seems a little upscale for that.
It's upscale, but I mean, at the same time, there's this massive parking lot just over on the other side of where we're sitting.
Right, but look at all the palm trees that they've put up, and they've really landscaped it well, and you come in here and you kind of feel, there's a lot of shopping too. I know I obviously focus on the food because I'm a food writer, but there's a lot of high-end shopping here as well. I didn't mention Soy 4, one of my favorite Thai restaurants in town, is also over there on that side.
Is it good for one restaurant to have a bunch of others in a center like this?
Yes, I think so, because like you said, we're kind of spread out, and if you have a cluster, then you're going to bring more people together, and then if one is busy, then they might walk over to another one, and I do think that there is greater strength in numbers.
Is that especially important in a strip mall setting where you're not going to get a lot of foot traffic? We're right on Scottsdale Road, and you're not really going to walk up and down Scottsdale Road too much in this part
right,
of town.
Right.
So I'd imagine that you kind of have to be coming to the center for something, maybe a restaurant, maybe something else. So is it helpful for one restaurant to have others in a place where you have to sort of drive to get to?
I do. I think that is probably true. But don't forget, right across the street behind us, away from Scottsdale Road, is a resort, the Hyatt at Gainey Ranch. And then behind that, from here all the way over to Hayden probably is all residential. Upscale residential, I might add again, and I think that, I don't know that they would walk, but it's not that far for them to drive over here. If you've got great restaurants, which I think now they finally have hit upon a nice mix, you've got a regional seafood restaurant, you've got a Mediterranean restaurant, you've got an Italian place that's amazing, you've got a fabulous Thai restaurant, Soy 4, there's a French creperie here, there's so much variety that that to me is what's kind of exciting about this spot. It's just that variety.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food writer for Phoenix Magazine.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments, a national wealth management firm serving investors for over 120 years with offices in Phoenix, Scottsdale, and now in Mesa with Deanne Griebel, Senior Vice President of Investments.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. There is something goofily magical about a popular song.
Hang on, stupid, stupid hang on.
Why this was a hit is one of those unanswered questions. Who could predict that something like this would make it?
Like the TV shows that make it or don't, there is no algorithm that can reliably calculate how and why Hang On Sloopy was one of the top songs of 1964, 50 years ago. If there is an algorithm for making hits, though, it lived once upon a time in the troubled heart of music producer Burt Burns, who gave the world Brown Eyed Girl, Under the Boardwalk, and Take Another Little Piece of My Heart. It's the story of music producer and writer Joel Selvin's new book, Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. Rhythm plus blues equals gold. And that was perhaps the first formula of pop music hits, and Burt Burns was right in the middle of it all.
Dead center, he was a gear that was pushed up against all the other gears in New York for 7 years, starting in 1960. Lieber and Stoller, Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler, Burt Bacharach, Phil Spector, Goffin and King, all of them had something to do with Burns. He sat in the center of them, and in many ways he made some of the best records any of those guys did.
Did Burt Burns want to be a songwriter, a performer? Did he love being a producer? He started his own record label, Bang Records.
Well, Burt Burns had rheumatic fever as a 14-year-old, and he was told that he wouldn't live to be 21. He dropped out of school and really didn't do anything with his life for a long time and didn't get into the record business until he was 30 years old. I think his show business ambitions were always there. He had sort of an interest in doing a little comedy, doing some mambo concerts, starting a record label in 1950 for a minute. But nothing came of that until 1960 when he landed a $50 a week job at Robert Mellon Music as a song plugger. And there he started writing songs. In 1961, he had his first chart record, the Jarmels, A Little Bit of Soap.
A little bit of soap will wash away your lipstick on my face. But a little bit of soap will never, 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 ever erase the pain in my heart.
And in 1962, he started producing records for Atlantic Records with Solomon Burke, whose records with Burns made him one of the biggest stars of rhythm and blues and saved Atlantic Records from a very dire financial condition.
I interviewed Solomon Burke.
Magnificent man.
Oh, a magnificent man, the greatest guy. And, you know, it just shows how ignorant I am. He was always talking about and thanking Burt. And I didn't know who the heck he was talking about. And the picture really wasn't filled out until I read this book.
Well, Solomon has some resentments over the songwriting credits on Everybody Needs Somebody to Love, which is shared equally between Solomon Burke, Burt Burns, and Jerry Wexler. We're not sure that either Wexler or Burns had much to do with the song's composition in it. If you listen to it, it reads exactly like a Solomon Burke sermon.
Sometimes you get what you want, and you lose what you have. And there's a song I sing, and I believe if everybody was to sing the song, you'd save the whole world. Listen to me.
You know, Solomon Burke's birth was foretold, and he was born 12 years later. There was already a church founded for him by his grandmother, and there was a lot of excitement around his birth. And at age 7, he was preaching. By the age of 9, he was traveling the country, taking his message out in the world. He made gospel records in the mid-50s and then dropped out after he wasn't being paid fairly and went into the undertaking business. Only came back into the record business because Wexler approached him and asked him to record for Atlantic. Amazing man.
Absolutely amazing. Tell me about Burt Burns's hits and what he saw in rock and roll, and particularly in even some of the Afro-Cuban success that he had in the mambo music that other people didn't see.
The important thing about Burns's music that distinguished it was this mambo influence. A lot of the New York songwriters and record producers of the era incorporated Latin rhythms. But Burns was strictly an Afro-Cuban guy, and the mambo is quite a bit different than the Brazilian kind of Latin music. It's a much more sinful, sensual, raunchy kind of rhythm and fiery stuff at the time. You look at a song like Twist and Shout, which Burns originally recorded with the Isley Brothers, and it's just taken off of the same chord progression that La Bamba and Guantanamera are based on. He loved that chord progression. He used it very, very effectively throughout his career.
A Latin tune. Man, you're opening my eyes, bud. You describe Here Comes the Night, the dark soul of Burt Burns. Boy, a lot of the pictures in here, he just seems to be on top of the world.
He was a Prince of Broadway.
What's the dark soul part?
Well, there's an ambiguity to that term intended. One, I'm referring to the kind of music that he made, which is, you know, soul music, and it's very dark. Burns's music pushes his singers to the edge of despair. There's an urgency, there's a hysteria to his music. It just lays in every song. So that sense, dark soul. The other is, of course, a reference to his doomed heart and the darkness that he lived under because of that.
He did not survive the R&B era. What would he think about our time right now?
Well, you know, Burt Burns was so much a man of his times, formed in the 40s and 50s and coming to age in the 60s and having such a great role, big part in opening up the musical culture. But Burns's songs, they're trapped in his pathology, and they just seem so intense and urgent and desperate. And I sensed out of those records somebody who was writing about himself, even though he didn't think that that was what he was doing.
Well, it's been great hanging out, Joel.
John, what a pleasure.
Joel Selvin's new book is Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Stop me if you've heard this before. People are heading to the New Mexico desert this weekend in search of the truth.
It's not Roswell this time, but Alamogordo, where video game enthusiasts will be searching for lost treasure. Nick Yaniti is with Fuel Entertainment, which is leading the dig.
30 years ago, a little company called Atari released a game called E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which was widely panned as one of the worst video games of all time. And at the time, they purportedly buried about 4 million copies of this game in the desert in order to get rid of the unsold stock.
Yaniti says the supposed dump has become one of the biggest urban legends in the video game industry.
He's not sure what they'll find in the desert, but he says every piece of evidence has led them to dig in this spot.
We're pretty confident that something from Atari will be there. Will it be the ET cartridges themselves, or will we even be able to find them within the area we're digging? We don't know 100%, but we're relatively confident.
Do you have any measure of optimism that even if the games were buried in that place, that 30 years later under the Southwest desert sun, that they'll still be there?
You know, the interesting thing about this project is the amount of people that have come forward, including archaeologists, and you know, the word on the street is that there's a fair chance that they could be relatively intact.
Is there a demand among gamers to have this game that back in the day was, as you said, so widely panned?
There are. If you look on eBay, there you can get copies of the game. We're not digging because it's impossible to get a copy. We're digging to uncover the myth behind what happened and find out if, you know, if it really happened and what exactly was buried there. People who just want to play it, you can get yourself a copy. But, you know, there are a certain level of fans and collectors that would love to have a piece of this. And, you know, whether it'll be playable, we don't know, but we'll find out.
If you're interested, you'll be able to get into the site tomorrow morning starting at 8:30. Digging starts at 9:30, and as we all know, the truth is out there.
You can take a trip to Italy to enjoy the wine, food, and olives, or you can visit a spot in the East Valley that'll make you feel like you've traveled thousands of miles. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us to Queen Creek.
The Queen Creek Olive Mill has been producing extra virgin olive oil for 10 years. The business is a tourist attraction where people can hang out to eat and drink under an olive tree. Did you know the Olive Mill is the state's only olive farm, mill, and retail store in Arizona?
I like to grow things. I love to cook. I'm Italian.
Perry Rea is the owner of the Queen Creek Olive Mill.
Well, you know, add those together and you get extra virgin olive oil. Right?
There are 7,100 trees here that produce 16 varieties of olives. Daily tours show just how it's done. Today, Rea is explaining how his mill produced 6,000 gallons of oil this season.
And as the oil rises up through the cones, all the organic material gets caught in the cones, and what comes out is very cool extra virgin olive oil.
Rea originally created the olive mill as a hobby, but as more and more people became aware of the homegrown olives and oil-making farm, local restaurant chefs became interested in the product. Today, this is the only place in Arizona where olives are grown, milled to produce extra virgin olive oil, and sold. Bet you're wondering, how can growing olives in Arizona be so fruitful? Well, olive trees grown for making oil need little water. The fruit requires long hot seasons to ripen, and Arizona doesn't have the type of pests often found in other parts of the world, like the olive fly. Even more helpful, the Arizona desert climate helps the olive tree grow faster.
We're a local brand, and I think I may maintain that local brand because I like being local.
You may not notice it when you drive up to the farm, but on the roof, there are more than 400 solar panels. It makes enough electricity to run the entire mill and produce all of the olive oil. Rea says, ultimately, making it a zero-carbon footprint product. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
Got ideas? Send them our way. The show at KJZZ.org.
As usual in the Valley, a lot of things going on this weekend. On Saturday, the National Day of Puppetry takes place. Great Arizona Puppet Theater all day from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Also, tomorrow is Pat's Run. The run begins at 7:05 a.m. at Sun Devil Stadium in Tempe.
Also on Saturday, the Chandler Crafts Spirits Festival. That's from 5 until 10 p.m. at Dr. A.J. Chandler Park. This has been the show on KJZZ. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is next on KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.